No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Today, we are lucky enough to have a very special guest with us, Marianne Williamson, author extraordinaire, about to release her 13th book with 4 New York Times number one bestsellers, an activist, political candidate, spiritual leader, and currently candidate for president of the United States in the Democratic primary. Ms. Williamson, thanks so much for being on our show. Maria, thank you for being here today. We very much appreciate. Hello, and we're very excited to have you on, Ms. Williamson.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
And let me ask you to start with, in 2014, you ran for Congress in California's 33rd district, and from what I understand, you did very well. But this is a big leap to run for president. So why? Why are you doing this?
I'm doing this because for the last 35 years, I've worked very closely with people trying to navigate the consequences of the damage that's been done by a very irresponsible political establishment. So I have very strong ideas about things that need to change. And I think that people whose mindset is entrenched in the worldview that took us to where we are, I think it's preposterous to say that they're the only people we should consider qualified to get us out of the ditch that we're in. I think things need to be said and things need to be done that don't necessarily emerge from the conversation that's been dominating politics. There's nothing in our Constitution that says that only people who have been senators or congressmen or governors should be qualified to run for president. I think that they made it the way they made it for a reason. They said somebody who's lived here for 14 years, someone who has who was born here, and someone who is 35 years or older. That's what makes you qualified, because they were leaving it to every generation to determine for itself the skill sets that are necessary to navigate this time. I think we need political vision right now. I think we need a political visionary more than we need a political mechanic. And so I feel that not just myself, but all kinds of people who do not necessarily emerge in our skill sets or in our viewpoints from the political establishment have the most important things to say and to offer right now.
Well, I can't agree with you more that this is not just the venue for politicians. Certainly some of our greatest presidents were people that didn't have political experience, especially in the beginning. Maria, I know you're dying to ask a question, so why don't you ask Ms. Williamson something?
I am. Ms. Williamson, I've noticed, and thank you for making yourself available to be on our program, that you have gotten some very favorable coverage, including a brilliant article earlier this week at SF Gate that went into various details about where you stand on policies. And I'm curious what your stand about the universal preschool is based upon, because that seems like a no-brainer to me, but you must be getting some opposition to that as well.
Well, one of the main pillars of my campaign is that I want a cabinet-level U.S. Department of Children and Youth. We have millions of American children who live in chronic trauma. We have millions of American children who go to schools every single day that don't even have the adequate school supplies to teach an 8-year-old to read. And if a child cannot read by 8, the chances of high school graduation are drastically diminished. The chances of incarceration are drastically increased. Some of these children, many of them, live in what are called America's domestic war zones, where the PTSD that they experience due to the violence in their homes, their communities, their schools, their families, is as great as the PTSD that is experienced by a returning veteran from Afghanistan or Iraq. And yet these children are simply neglected. It's almost as though they are invisible, because since they can't work, they have no financial leverage. And in a country where our government has become little more than a system of legalized bribery, how can these children possibly compete with the clout of these multinational corporate forces that dominate our politics today? Now, you asked about preschool. The truth of the matter is many of these children, and I know a lot of people wouldn't believe this, a lot of people don't want to think this is true, a lot of these children are traumatized even before three. We have elementary school students in this country who are on suicide watch. So to me, the whole issue of children and the trauma of children and what I see as the humanitarian crisis of millions of children in America today, whose despair we have simply normalized, starts at birth. So it's so much bigger than what we think of as education. This is so much bigger than spending more money on education or having universal preschool. That goes back to the first question you asked me, why am I running? I'm running because the entire conversation we're having doesn't even begin to get to the heart of the matter of everything from lack of maternal health, lack of parental leave, lack of the all of the things that we need culturally, medically, in terms of the food that these children have, in terms of addressing issues of poverty, addressing issues of hunger in America. So, yeah, I want universal preschool, but I want more than that. I want the universal rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that theoretically God gave us according to our Declaration of Independence, that governments are instituted to secure, and that every child, because these children are full-on citizens of the United States, should receive. So universal preschool is like small compared to what I want these kids to have.
Well, wow. you just won the vote of my wife, who's a teacher and a school librarian, I can tell you that. I want to ask you, because this seems so central to the things that you've written about responsibility. You said in an article to the Washington Post, if we want to change our lives, we have to ask ourselves deeply what part we've played and what America has become. What exactly do we have to do? What kind of reflection do we need to take as citizens to heal ourselves?
I think we have to ask about our country the same thing that we ask about ourselves. If you want to change your life, you have to get real. You have to get real with who you are, how you're behaving, where you are and where you're not the person that you like to think that you are, where you are and where you're not standing on ethics and principles. You have to take what is called an AA, a fearless moral inventory. So I think that what we're talking about with children is a perfect example, where we are practicing collective child neglect. We don't like to think of ourselves as a country that way. And we're not going to change as a country until we're willing to have a kind of fiercely honest, brutally self-aware conversation with ourselves and among us as citizens that we would have in our own individual lives. We have to do the same thing with race. That's why I talk about reparations for slavery. We have to have a more real and meaningful conversation about race. We don't have that in politics today. We get real outside politics. Politics should be the place where we get most real. And the other place where I feel that we need to have a serious conversation among ourselves as citizens has to do with our national security agenda. We spend profoundly massive resources on preparing for war. But for every $1 we spend on creating peace, we spend over $1,000 on war preparedness. When waging peace, just like you can't just take medicine, you have to also cultivate your health. We can't just prepare for war. We have to cultivate peace. You cultivate peace by expanding economic opportunities for women, expanding educational opportunities for children, reducing violence against women, and addressing and ameliorating unnecessary human suffering wherever possible. But those things don't make corporate profits, and preparing for war does make corporate profits. So our system is so profoundly corrupt We don't fight climate change adequately because, God forbid, it should cut into the profits of fossil fuel companies. We don't have common sense gun legislation because, God forbid, it should cut into the profits of gun manufacturers. We don't have universal health care because, God forbid, it should cut into the profits of health insurance companies and big pharma. And we don't wage peace adequately because, God forbid, it should cut into the profits of defense contractors. The American people need to look at this. We are a good people. We are a decent people. This is in our personal lives. We know this, but we have stopped. We have gotten out of the habit of considering issues of public morality. We've stopped. We've gotten out of the habit of considering issues of public ethics. How we're behaving as a country around the world affects the world. We have sacrificed moral leadership, and we have acquiesced domestically to an economic system that, rather than serving the majority of our people, runs roughshod over the majority of our people. That's the conversation I'm having. That's why I'm running for president, because I don't hear anybody within the political establishment who it's not like I don't, you know, I have a lot of respect for people who are running. This is not personal. But the traditional conversation only addresses the symptoms. It doesn't address the cause. It waters the leaves, but it doesn't water the roots. And until we develop a politics where we're having a serious and real and authentic conversation about what's really wrong in this country, we will not be able to make it right.
Well, as a politician, I have to agree that we do pander consistently to being popular rather than having the introspective conversation that you're talking about. I think that's very true, that, you know, we're always trying to say things in a way that makes us popular with people rather than standing up for the things that maybe we should be standing up for. And I'm fascinated that you quote one of my favorite politicians, FDR, saying that administration is secondary to leadership for the president, because I think that's very lacking today. What would you do to bring leadership to the presidency?
Well, first of all, I want to go back to something you just said, because I think it's very important. That's exactly true. The politics today panders to popularity, and that's exactly the point. So politicians want to be popular, so they're afraid too often to, you know, it's like, I don't want to upset you. You know, if I talk to people about the fact that the U.S. Air Force has ordered 100 B-21 Raiders, the B-21 Raiders each cost $550 million, that each one carries conventional as well as nuclear bombs. On one hand, it's so preposterous. Why do we need airplanes that each carry nuclear bombs? On the other hand, what you said, most politicians don't want to bring that up because, you know, don't want to be Debbie Downer. And so the politics of popularity is the problem, isn't it? Because they're trying to get elected. And I think that's exactly what, you know, I mean, on one hand you say, well, you're not going to get elected doing that. On the other hand, you know, Donald Trump is president. So I don't think anyone can predict who can get elected in America today. And also, I believe the American people are ready for a real conversation. So thank you for mentioning that about the politics of pandering to popularity. You know, living a meaningful life is not a popularity contest. And politics should not so much be a popularity contest as a meaning contest, a truth contest. And sometimes telling the truth is not going to make you popular immediately. You know, I heard somebody say the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. You know, the truth will set you free, but first it will depress you a little bit. So, and that's what, and we're grown-ups. The American people are grown-ups. We have a political system that talks to us like we're children, and it infantilizes us, and then we behave that way. And then I'm sorry, Senator, because you went to something else, and I said, no, I want to go back to that. I don't remember what the other thing was now, do you?
What? Yes, you quote FDR and saying administration.
Yes, I'm sorry.
You know, we refer to the presidency as administrative branch. So,
what he said was that the administrative functions are secondary to moral leadership. And I think that that's the reason I'm talking about here on the phone right now, because I would do it as a president. What I'm doing as a candidate is saying we must be a moral nation. You cannot neglect millions of children living in chronic trauma.
That is a moral issue. Economic injustice is a moral issue. When you have 1%, when you have a tiny portion of your population enjoying tremendous wealth, while 40% of Americans are struggling just to make, you know, basic costs of food and rent, transportation and health, that is a moral issue. The fact that there is this consistent racial disparity economically, in terms of race, in terms of criminal sentencing, et cetera, mass incarceration, this is a moral issue. The fact that America puts puts short-term profits for defense contractors in this constant war machine and the building up of this war machine, calling it security, when really it's less about security and more about profits for a certain segment, over actually waging peace and standing up for our values around the world, that is a moral issue. And so when you say, how would I do it? I would do it the way I'm doing it. And that's why I'm running for president, by having this conversation with the American people. And if the American people then feel that's the consciousness of who should be president, then they elect you. And by electing you, they are saying, I want you to use the powers of the executive branch to try to turn these ideas into action.
May I ask?
And that, to me, is what leadership is.
I can't agree with you more about what you're talking about with morals and ethics, but I wonder how evolved the American public is in that regard. Better, since that's your business, about teaching enlightenment. And get, like you said, the truth will piss you off, but it'll set you free. You've spent decades trying to help us understand that. How do you think the average American is going to be able to engage in this kind of conversation? Because it sounds a little bit erudite, if you will, even though what you're talking.
How is it erudite to say we really should rescue children? We should rescue children who are trapped. You know, whether you call it the cradle to prison pipeline or whatever you want to call it, these children are trapped. How is it? That's not an, to me anyway, it's not an esoteric conversation. You could take, I believe that the American people are good and decent people. I believe that we have a sense of fair play and we have a sense of justice. And if you tell Americans, you know, it's characterological with us. If you tell an American one child is suffering, the Americans really care about that one child. It's when it's thousands or millions of them that sometimes we disconnect from what's really happening. But then on the other hand, we haven't had a politics in a long time that says to people, address this. We had Bobby Kennedy who addressed it. We had even Lyndon Johnson with a war on poverty and how we should be a good society. We don't have a politics that presents to the American people the option, first you do the right thing. So I'm not, you know, it's interesting. We always say, how do you convince people? Did the abolitionists say, how are we going to convince people? Did the suffragettes say, how are we going to convince people? Did the civil rights movement say, how are we going to convince people? That can't be. That's just people-pleasing. That's just pandering to popularity. To me, somebody has to say what needs to be said, in my opinion. I mean, some people say that's not what needs to be said. I understand that. But I, in my heart, want to say what I believe needs to be said, what I believe a leader should be saying, what I believe a president should be saying. And then it's up to the American people, you know, whether or not they choose that. And that's democracy, and that's as it should be. But I wouldn't write off the conscience of the American people. We haven't given the American people in a long time the choice, vote here for doing the right thing. And I think, you know, I my experience traveling the country is that we are people who care. But when it comes to politics, we just farmed out our conscience. And that's why we are where we are today.
Well, you know, I agree with a lot of what you say, Ms. Williamson. And I think you're a very important voice. It's one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the show, is because I think the things you're saying are very important. And I think America needs to hear them. But, you know, when it comes to things like children, we all talk about you know, making better lives for children. But then the first thing we do is cut education when the budget gets tight. So why is it that we can talk the talk, but we can't walk the walk, as we say in politics?
All right, now let's talk about what's really happened here. So the Republican Party has become completely, you know, bought and sold by forces that actually believe that society should be organized by market forces untethered to ethical principles. We all know that. But I believe that even the Democratic Party, far too often, seeks to minimize the pain on the periphery with saying things like, oh, we should give more money to education. But it too often, morally equivocates and will not fundamentally address the underlying forces that cause all that suffering. So, in a way, the reason we don't get a dollar is because we're asking for a dime. Because only if you ask for the dollar does asking for the dollar come with a genuine moral argument for why you need the money. You know, if you have a politics that's not even addressing and informing people, look, people, you know, and people do know, people are not stupid. Our children are, we have all these teenagers who are on heroin. We have all this domestic abuse. We have all these horrifying societal dysfunctions that arise from the petri dish of human despair. We have a society in which millions and millions of people, far too many people, live with chronic economic anxiety and tension. And we know that where those factors are present, there is a higher incidence of domestic abuse, of child abuse, of hunger, of crime, of all the things that emerge when people simply don't feel that they live and dwell in a space of possibility for their lives. So we need to stand on what we really believe. And that's why I'm running, because, you know, I think that's the struggle today in the Democratic Party between the corporatist Democrat and the Democrat is trying to bring, as I am and as others are, a more real conversation about what's happening in this country. And I don't rule out the idea that the American people would go for it if provided. I think, personally, that we elected Obama in 08 thinking he was going to do that. I mean, in my opinion, he had a mandate in 08 for moving in the direction of fundamental moral repair in this country. And then he deviated from that and went into a more, you know, we want to have it both ways. We want to play footsies under the table with the corporatists and make it all okay because of who gives donations, blah, blah, blah. But I think the very fact that this country elected him in 08 proved that the American people were open and ready.
Well, given what you just said, you ran as an independent for Congress. Is running as a Democrat, is that a practical decision on your part?
You know, I've always been a Democrat my whole life, but I'm a Democrat. You know, everything I'm saying to you, this is what Bobby Kennedy said. You know, this is, yes. I grew up at a time when this is how Democrats talked. You know,
yes.
When I was
yes.
growing up, this is how Democrats talk. You know, it's what now seems like far left used to be considered kind of like, duh. You know, it wasn't considered a fringe conversation. Like, hello, you serve the people first. This should not be considered a radical leftist idea. This is radical only in the sense that democracy is radical. When I ran as an independent, first of all, it was a very naive thing to do, but it was a principled position because I am aware of American history. Abolition came from the abolitionist party. Women's suffrage came from the suffrage, from the women's party. Social Security came from the socialist party. And there has been this, what I have believed, is a kind of unholy alliance over the last few decades between Democrats and Republicans. However, that was then and this is now. I see the whole issue of the parties, even some of what you and I have been talking about already, as kind of two broken legs and two broken arms. Certainly worthy of a family conversation. But I see this president's agenda as a bullet near the heart. And right now, this is not a time to risk. I would not do anything to risk, whether I'm the nominee or someone else is the nominee. I would not do anything to risk taking even 10 votes away from the Democratic nominee in order to defeat this president in 2020. And I feel also that I'm having the conversation, the Democratic Party, you know, like I said, traditionally, the Democratic Party of my childhood, this is what the Democratic Party stood for.
Well, you know, I have to say in reading some stuff that you've written, that came back to me over and over again, that these things have been said, that, you know, Dr. King said only light can drive out darkness, only love can conquer hate. So I agree with you 100% on that. I think that these are not necessarily new ideas to democracy, but ideas that have somehow been beaten down in our system. Maria, I know you're dying to ask a question.
Yes, I don't want to interrupt.
I don't want to monopolize the conversation.
Ms. Williams, I know you've been a frequent guest on Oprah Winfrey. Have you had any conversations with her about her participation in your campaign?
No, I haven't, and I wouldn't. You know, Oprah is a very serious woman, and Oprah will do what all of us are doing. We are listening very deeply to what everyone is saying. I'm sure she is aware, as everybody else is. This is a very serious moment in history. The choice that we will make and who we vote for in the primaries, the caucuses, who we support, is a decision that should be made after careful listening to all of the candidates. And I'm sure she will do that, like everyone will do that. And she will support, if she does publicly support someone, I'm sure she will support the person that she honestly feels is the best to lead this country forward. It certainly won't be based on who's her girlfriend any more than it would be for you or me. I can think of one person I knew who ran once, and I love him. He's a good friend, but I wasn't going to vote for him. You know, she's not a silly woman, and she would not be behaving in a silly way.
Let me ask you about a few of your policies, because I'm sure our listeners are really interested in this. I know you support a $15 minimum wage, and I'm proud to say that when I ran for re-election in November, we used people from a shelter work program. We paid each one of them $15 an hour. We fed them lunch and provided them with transportation, because I, too, believe that should be the minimum wage. You want reparations, free college education, Medicare for all, and of course, most importantly to us, to me personally, is that I represent constituents that have no voice in either House of Congress, and we seek to resolve that by making D.C. the 51st state. How do you feel about these things?
Absolutely. You know, that's what we fought in the American Revolution, the idea of no taxation without representation. No, every person who lives in America and is a citizen of the United States should have a vote, period, end of story. I think that when the founders first drew all these plans, they did not foresee that there would be all these citizens living in the District of Columbia. So I think those days are over. It's a new time, and it's a very vibrant and important place, and every citizen there should have proper representation in Congress.
Well, thank you for that. Also, as the father of three children, one who is just finishing college, I'm intrigued about, do you believe that college should be free to children that graduate from high school, or should the government help pay for it? What is your plan for that?
I believe this is how I feel about the larger conceptualization of how this country operates. First of all, I take very seriously when Lincoln said that people died at Gettysburg so that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people would not perish from this earth. It's perishing now because we're a government of a few of the people, by a few of the people, and for a few of the people. Only a few people in America today can easily afford college. Only a few people in America today can easily afford the health care that they need for themselves and their children. Only a few people today are able to experience the opportunities that could be easily available to every hardworking American. Now, to me, the source of money lies in human creativity and productivity. The source of money is not a few corporate moguls. That's not where money comes from. That's a canard. That's an illusion. That's been a thief fast talking you. Money comes from people who are able to actualize their dreams. Money comes from people living the lives that they really in their hearts want to live. And they bring all their energy and they bring all their productivity. And we have all these young people. If you want to see the entrepreneurial spirit of the United States of America that would give us sustainable economic vibrancy for 100 or 200 years, I'll tell you where you see it. In any kindergarten anywhere in America. We are the only advanced country that bases so much of our educational funding on property taxes. Now, all of that gold, that's gold. Every time you don't educate a child, that's just gold slipping through your fingers. So whether it's kindergarten, preschool or college. To me, it's all the same thing. I want, and if I'm president of the United States, I want every young person to feel, this is my contract. This is my contract with you, young person. I'm going to do everything I can. And I want and the U.S. government, every person should feel this from their government. Your government is going to do everything you can to help you thrive. And in return, you are going to be the man or the woman that you're capable of being. You're going to be the parent. You're going to be the child. You're going to be the sibling. You're going to be the citizen. You're going to be the friend. You're going to be the partner. You're going to be the spouse. You're going to be the employer. You're going to be the employee. You're going to be the creator. You're going to be the producer, that it's filled with so much energy that you're putting out there, that America is better for that. That's what makes America great. You make America great by helping people be great. So to me, free college is just, yes, of course, any young person, they have dreams, they have abilities, and it starts with those little eight-year-old brains. What happens, you know, so much of what happens cognitively is in the brain of a child before the age of eight. And that's why I feel so strongly about these children being able to read. But then absolutely, if these people, not only to get the education, but look at all our young people, and not our young people, our baby boomers even, who are burdened by these college loans. I think that we have been mentally trained to forget this is the richest country in the world. This is unnecessary. This craziness is due to policies. It's due to giving tax breaks. This 2017 tax break, $2 trillion, where 83 cents of every dollar goes to the very, very richest. These corporate subsidies, so many ways in which we today behave like a veiled aristocracy. Wealth is a good thing. The problem with America today is not enough people have a chance to create it. There's wealth and then there's aristocracy. There are many people who made their money righteously in America, and that's to be celebrated. An aristocracy is when a government keeps passing laws and producing policy that makes it easier for the very rich to get even richer and harder for anyone else to create wealth at all. That's why education matters. It's a way that people are able to more fully self-actualize, and that's where dreams take form. And one of the forms is enough money to feed your kids, to take your family to dinner every once in a while, to have cash on hand to do what you most want to do with your life.
So, Ms. Williamson, that sounds like it's along the lines of what you'd like to do when you propose the Department of Domestic Peacebuilding. And can you speak to that if the listeners aren't familiar with what you're hoping to do with the...
Department of Domestic Peacebuilding. Right now, as I was saying earlier, we need to do more than just prepare for war. We need to create peace. We need to wage peace. Donald Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense under George Bush, said that. General Mattis, before he left the Department of Defense, said, if you're not going to fully fund the State Department, I'm going to have to buy more ammunition. So we need to wage peace. Like when you and I were talking about these children, we need wraparound services. We need conflict resolution. We need restorative justice. We need anti-poverty programs. We need all of those factors that actually create peace. And what I have found traveling this country is that we have all the expertise we need. We have the social workers. We have the elementary school teachers. We have people like yourself, from the way you were described, a teacher, a librarian. We have the people. I'm sure you'd agree with me, and please tell me if you don't. We have the people who would know what to do, but these people are underfunded. And it's not only with children. It's also with people who are coming out of prison. It's with people who have been gang members. It's with all kinds of situations in life, whether it has to do with domestic abuse, whether it has to do with community relations, where people are living at the effect of horrible, horrible instances of violence, both in the heart and on our streets, that could be addressed. And if we have a U.S. Department of Peace, then we have a way to coordinate all of these peace-building efforts. And that's what the government's resources should be spent on.
Which is akin with what you say about the government shouldn't be run like a business, it should be run like a family.
Well, right now it's run like a business, but it's run like the worst kind of business, where all you're caring about really is your fiduciary responsibility to stockholders. And that's how our government does run today. It runs like the worst kind of business, where only the people who have bought stock, you only care about the people who have bought stock, and the people who have bought stock are the campaign donors, particularly since Citizens United. And so you know, as I said, it shouldn't be run like a business. It should be run like a family. And right now it is run like a business, but the very worst kind.
Well, you know, that's said over and over again in politics, that people want the government run more like a business, which in to me is absolutely absurd. Because if you could run the government like, if you could run the government like a business, you wouldn't need government.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, I think that people talk, when they say that, they mean that they wish government was more efficient. But truly, right. You know, there's a absolute difference between, I've done both. I've worked in government, I've run a business. And, you know, in business, you have a bottom line, and that's profit. And if you're going to run the government like a business, that's going to be the bottom line for government. I think you're so right about that. Let me ask you, what happens to children? Yes, what happens to children? And it is a disgrace what we do. I live in Washington, D.C., which is one of the richest jurisdictions in America. And our school system is 49th out of 51 in America. And it's absolutely a disgrace. We have more people that have graduate degrees in the District of Columbia than any other place in the world, yet we treat our children that live in the poorest parts of the city as if they don't even exist. So I agree with
you
100%.
That's exactly right.
Exactly. Let me ask you, you endorsed Bernie Sanders last time he ran, and several candidates have already come out and said that several male candidates have come out and said they would choose a woman as vice president. As you go down the campaign trail, if somebody like Sanders were to get the nomination and want you to join his ticket, would you be interested in that kind of thing?
I sort of, that would surprise me, actually. However, I that's not the kind of question that, you know, somebody asked me on a radio show today. Any decision I make related to this campaign would come from a very deep place of reflection and prayer, not some impulsive answer. So,
fair enough.
I wouldn't be running if I wasn't desirous of serving my country in whatever way would be meaningful.
Well, I think you have an important message to get out there, and I'm very glad that you're part of this process, just to be honest. Maria,
go ahead. And here is the protective side of me. And I know you're a big woman and a successful one. I don't mean big as in large. I mean big as in a huge person and what effect you've had in our society. I have friends that have been freed by some of the things that you've written and you've shared and you've revealed. I have a friend who was at your inaugural party in Beverly Hills when you announced your candidacy. So I've been touched by you personally and by your work and by what you've done to others. And I'm worried about you and this horrible process that is called political process, how we choose a candidate. And as I said at the beginning, I know you can take care of yourself, but what you have to say is so meaningful on so many levels. And I don't know how you're going to get that heard, because we're about sound bites and unfortunately about mudslinging and, you know, cutting people off at the knees and everything that you don't stand for.
Well, I'm talking to you right now, aren't I?
Yes.
So, I'm on Morning Joe tomorrow, and I have my CNN town hall on April 14th, and I can't be in control of those things, but I did not run. This was not an impulsive decision. I don't think it's an impulsive decision for anyone, and it took me a year and a half to process. How are you going to take the inevitable humiliation? How are you going to take the inevitable embarrassment? How are you going to take the inevitable criticism? How are you going to take the incredible mean-spiritedness? How are you going to take the bad pictures? But you know what? You and I are American women. Think what they are going to do to us compared to what would happen if you and I, if I said a fraction of the things that I've said to you on this call today, there are countries where if I said a fraction of those things, I would be thrown in prison and tortured. What have we become as American women that we're so scared, particularly at a time like this, to say what we know in our hearts needs to be said? The American woman is not a porcelain doll. And this preciousness that we're all just tolerating a situation where it's like nobody's saying what we all know to be true. Nobody's talking about the things that we all know to be true. They're gonna throw tomatoes at me. They already are. But then there's the rest of it. There's the fact that I'm talking to you. There's the fact that, you know, for everybody who has something awful to say, there's somebody who has something deep and real to say. You know, I think in our world today, we are too enamored of the idea of the majority. The majority didn't wake up one day and say, let's free the slaves. The majority didn't wake up one day and say, let's give women the right to vote. The majority didn't wake up one day and say, let's end segregation. It begins with a few people who know that it's not the majority, but it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what caused that kind of conviction is a force multiplier. And then there's a certain power and force that emerges from the quantum field of just a resonant conversation. I feel like this country is like an alcoholic family system where the children are registering that there's a lot the grown-ups aren't saying. So I feel that my greatest service is saying not what I think people want to hear. I'm not running for people pleaser and she. I think we need leadership back in this country. And leaders say what needs to be said, not necessarily what's popular at the moment. And I'm betting on the fact that there are many Americans who are adult enough to want to have a more real, meaningful, and adult conversation in our political field.
Well, you know, given that conversation and given the fact that you brought up women, my dad used to say there's an upside and a downside to everything. So is the upside to what's going on now with this increased talk about misogyny, that women are finally standing up? The Me Too movement has really taken hold. We see more women being elected to Congress. Is this the upside of what's going on right now? How do you feel about that?
Well, in terms of the topic that you mentioned, absolutely, that's the upside. Yeah, I mean, it's very clear. It's a new day, and everything that you just described, there's a big upside there. An upside about women being in power, being elected. Look what just happened in Chicago last night. I mean,
yeah.
This is extraordinary.
Amazing.
This is extraordinary. So I think clearly that's the upside of the Me Too movement and this broader mainstream recognition about the dimensions of misogyny. I think there's been a delayed reaction on the part of a lot of people to the misogyny that was at the heart of the Trump campaign and many of the attitudes against Hillary, including among women, who I think realize there's a lot of internalized misogyny. And unfortunately, she was at the effect of that.
Well, traditionally, women have not necessarily been as supportive as one another. And in my career in radio, I was usually the token woman in the room. And because of that, because there was more tokenism, if you will, I think traditionally women were afraid that if another woman got in, then they'd be shown the door because you can't have that many women around. And fortunately, that's not the case now. I've had mentors, female mentors in my life, later in life that I didn't have growing up. And I don't think that our younger women are having that kind of discriminatory behaviors in their minds or in their conversations because they see women leaders and women physicians and women attorneys and women Supreme Court justices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'll be so glad when we can stop saying the first woman to run a major city. You know,
you.
I mean, it's like enough.
I agree with you entirely.
And California had to legislate. Entirely. Hannah Beth Jackson had to legislate that a female has to be on a publicly held board of directors by 2020. And that had to become law in order for women to be allowed to sit at the table and have the conversation.
I think there have been so many pictures in the last 2 years of the Trump administration that is just this celebration of an old white boys club that, you know, I said to somebody, look at those pictures because you won't be seeing them again. Once this wave is over, it'll never be the same. That's something that will be put to bed forever.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you're right about that. As a father of two daughters, you know, my wife calls me a great theoretical feminist, that I believe all women should be equal, except for her and my kids. So
I've noticed that myself. I've said to a few people, I know some men who love, they love the goddess. It's just real women they have a problem with.
Absolutely.
I have found that to be true in my life. Have you found that, Ms. Williamson?
Absolutely. They love the, like you said, theoretical feminism. I love the divine goddess. It's the rise of the divine goddess. Yeah, but then still they're treating women in a way that that is a disconnect from that. So, and I also think what you said, Maria, was very true, that sometimes it's women who are hardest on us, other women. Mm-hmm. And I see sometimes criticism of myself, and I feel like writing back, I bet you call yourself a feminist. You know, because sometimes, you know, people think of themselves one way and then really display don't display the level of sisterhood. That when I was growing up in the first wave of feminism back in the 70s, it was really understood as part of the feminist ethos that sisterhood was imperative, that none of us would get there unless all of us got there. And if anything, I would like to see different today. It's a spirit of sisterhood, and that needs to go beyond I believe her. You know, sometimes we will support someone who is weakened more than we will support someone who is strengthened. We all have the moments in our lives where we're down, and we have the moments in our lives where we're up. We all go through things. But sometimes there's a way in which, you know, like let's say in the Me Too movement, I believe her, I believe the victim. But sometimes there are some people who have a harder time supporting someone who is standing in her strength. I think that that's part of what misogyny is. It's not anti-woman. It's anti-woman having her own mind. It's anti-woman owning her own power. It's anti-woman just not asking for a seat at the table, but simply sitting there without asking permission. And I think that that misogyny towards women who empower themselves, who are not waiting to be empowered by the culture, but simply empower themselves, that brings up a lot for people. It triggers a lot of people still, women and men. And that, I think, is something that all of us need to look at in order to evolve the way we wish to evolve.
Well, I believe that that's really a perfect example of what you talk about when you say that we need to ask ourselves deeply what part we played. You know, when my wife accuses me of being a misogynist, I say to her, I was raised, you know, by my mother and my grandmother, never had a male teacher until I was in college. So the attitudes that were transferred to me very often were transferred by women. I try to be, like I say, I try to be a feminist, but, you know, you can try and not always succeed. Let me ask you, we're running out of time here. And first, I'd like you to tell people how they can get in touch with your campaign, what your website is. And then I'd like to ask you to say anything that you'd like to say that we haven't asked you.
Oh, thank you. My website is Marianne2020, and I hope the people will look at it. I hope the people will look at the issues. I hope people will remember that in order for me to be on the DNC debate stage, I need 25,000 more unique donations, so even a dollar counts for that. In terms of what you haven't asked me, I don't think, first of all, I appreciate everything that you've asked me, and so I would throw that back to you as well for anything that you guys want to talk about. But one of the things that I do want to point out is that we have a president who has harnessed fear for political purposes. And I think the only way to counter that is that if we harness love for political purposes, far more people in this country love than hate. But those who hate, hate with conviction. Those who hate, the racists, the bigots, the homophobes, the anti-Semites, the xenophobes, the Islamophobes have gotten serious and convicted and organized and have become effective. And now those of us who love, those of us who appreciate dignity and compassion, we need to get serious too. We need to become as convicted with our love as some people are already convicted behind their hate. we need to become as serious. You know, Martin Luther King said that those of us who love peace must organize as effectively as those who love war. And I hope people find and feel that my campaign is a, somebody said to me, this is a love train. I hope people feel that this is a field of possibility where we're standing for love. And love is not passive, and love is not Hallmark card that you help a child in trouble. That's what love is, that you take a moral inventory and try to pay your moral debts and do right by people by creating more racial and economic justice. That's what love is. That you seek to wage peace, to ameliorate human suffering. That's what love is. And when we do that, this country will transform from the inside out in ways that are probably unimaginable to most of us now.
Well, I have to agree that it's the oldest political ruse to pit one person against another and to say it's really not your fault, it's your neighbor's fault. And I think the fact that you preach a sort of a gospel of introspection and love is just such a positive thing. And I must tell you, Ms. Williamson, as a former hippie, I relate to you in so many ways. And I'm sorry that we don't have more time because I'd love to. There's 100 questions I haven't asked that I'd love to ask. But maybe you can come join us again. And before I leave the air, I'm going to give Maria the last word. But I'd also like to say thank not only you for coming on the show and being part of this, but I'd also like to thank Brent Roski, who's on your staff, who I was a pleasure to meet in Iowa when I came to the caucuses last time, for setting this up, for helping us set this up. And I hope when I come to Iowa in February, I get a chance to meet you. And I want you to know that I intend to be a super delegate at the convention in Milwaukee. I've been a super delegate in the past 3 presidential nominating conventions. I've been to the last 10. I played a role in the last 10 Democratic nominating conventions. So if there's anything I can do for you, please feel free to ask. Maria, your turn.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
And I want to thank you for elevating the conversation that surrounds this process and for leading by example. And one of the quotes that resonates with me and a lot of my friends that you share about our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Can you apply that to your campaign as well?
Well, you know, when you say our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate, our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. I think that this applies to our citizenship as well as to areas of our personal lives. We're playing very small as citizens. And the Constitution of the United States was written in a way as to give power to the people. And where that was not practiced at our inception, the narrative of our history is one in which we expand that sense of power beyond just white people, beyond just men, beyond just straight people, that we really recognize that everyone has equal rights, but with equal rights come equal responsibilities. And you can only live and live up to your responsibilities if you claim the power that comes from that. And so to me, this is a time for a new expanded dimension of citizenship in the average American that has to begin also with education. We have 11 states in the country who don't even require a half a year of civics and history. So to me, owning our light means owning the power that we are the people, and we the people are supposed to be running these things, running this country. And when the American people rise in our own awareness of this, it's going to be a miraculous change in this country. And I'm glad to feel that in some way my campaign could be part of that.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and before I let Maria say goodbye, let me say to our listeners, go on to Ms. Williamson's website and contribute at least $1, because this is a person that should be involved in the debate. This is a voice that needs to be heard.
And thank you so much. Very much for your courage and for your time and for your message. You're obviously changing the parameters of the discourse, which is beautiful in and of itself.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. And we'll see you next week. And we're going to leave you with a song from the Beatles in honor of our guest today, All You Need Is Love. Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote.